on rapid transit in 63.
And in the speech in 1971, he said that there was opposition to MATA from white.
One, two, three, four, five, six.
All right. Okay, what I guess I was curious about there is whether there was any racial aspect to the white opposition to rapid transit in Atlanta. Was it because black was becoming a black city and there was a lack of desire to put improvements into the city on that basis?
Well, you know, to be very honest with you, but the atmosphere at that time would not rule that out, not at all. The fact that you had a city that was rapidly becoming predominantly black in terms of population and in terms of political control. Oh, of course, in my judgment, played a role in it, because as a technical matter, but for that, rapid transit is good for Georgia.
Right.
You know, so if you remove the possibility of the fact that there was some racial situation involved, then, of course, rapid transit would be good for Georgia, so that had to play in my judgment upon it. I was very strongly vocally for it. The black leadership was very strongly vocally for it.
There was really no black opposition then to rapid transit, I suppose.
Not any substantial. Mm-hmm. You always have some, but the black leadership, the Jesse Hills at that time, the Sam Williams, Q.B. Williams, all those people in the paper.
I was just struck by the fact that you mentioned Maddox in that speech. You know, if Maddox is involved, then there's some racial thing to it. That's why I was curious about that. I think the first rapid transit bond failed. What was the reason behind that?
Two reasons, I think. We were very well trying to extract some agreement from MATA and that group as to the length of the line, where the lines were going. Fair black participation and all that business. Well, originally, at first, they thought that this was their project, a white project, quote unquote. They thought to get it passed without significant involvement from some of us who were, at that time, had some clout in terms of turning out votes. Well, they just went ahead and kind of ramrodded the notion of putting it on the ballot and getting it through. And so when it first came up, that was not this kind of enthusiasm among those of us who were there to support it.
So in other words, they didn't ask for any input from the black community.
Very little consultation.
And so the black community came out and supported it. What was done after that?
After that, then we had meetings. Then the die was cast. They had to have our support there to pass it. Agreement was made to carry the line to Perry Home without any question. That was the agreement. The agreement was for 15 cent fare. Agreement was for black participation in terms of lawyers involved in handling the transaction and in terms of employment in the MATA structure, the MATA system itself. And we struck those agreements, but we didn't do it as Peter Zach Gill would have done, and that is in writing. He would say, I want you to swear in blood that you will not recede from the Senate position. Go into a conference committee. Well, we didn't make them swear in blood. The result being is that there's no documentation as to what they agreed and what the black leadership in terms of securing our support for the passage of that funding.
Okay, today, did they hold on to the other agreement?
Not as it related to Perry Home.
That's right. That's good.
That's good. And then they tried to renege several times over 15 cents. Before it actually was worked out that it would move from 15 cents. And we held fast to that and kept it at 15 cents for as long as we did.
How about black lawyers being put on as consultants, or?
They did some of that, but not to the extent to which the agreement was. For instance, even after the bond issue was passed, we had to then go back to the table and begin to fight for black participation. That is, in terms of lawyers, bond lawyers. Stell Huey and his party had the whole legal proposition of matter, what Mata also had. And we had to kind of penetrate.
So it was like a lot of other deals they made. They promised things, they got black support, and they people had to do it. I've seen that a few other bond referendums, other things. So the right opposition then is coming from not people like Ivan Allen, that party. Well, that group of city business leaders, I mean, from Maddox and I guess rural legislators, people didn't care that much about the city.
That's basically the idea.
Yeah. Going back to one of your other speeches, 1963, he said that there are 48,000 Negroes voting in the black vote, and this is why we have a good atmosphere in the black vote. I've always heard so much about tradition of racial cooperation in the city. Is that based on black votes that didn't exist before?
Well, it did not exist before to the same extent. The only thing that I think that has distinguished Atlanta from other cities has been probably the atmosphere of willingness to relate and to confer with black leadership, over against the lack of that atmosphere in Birmingham and yourself and others. The fact that we had a raft of good who created an atmosphere through this paper, and the fact that you had an Ivan Allen or Hartsfield who may not love, who did not love black people, but who had a keen sense of political reality. Because of that sense of political reality, was prepared and willing to work with that, to cooperate with them, to give something.
Was this hospital in 1948, not hospital in 1938?
No. But the hospital only after black people obtained the right to vote. For instance, that it increased their voting strength. For instance, prior to that, I recall very vividly, A.T. Walden having related the story to us, how they went to Huntsville and asked for a certain concession for black, and he immediately told them, wait just a minute, if you want me to do this, then you have to put more black people on the voting list. It either had to do with black policemen or for some other issue that was very awkward.
He said, come back with that 10,000.
Come back and we have 10,000 votes. And we created a voter registration plan. So my reference to that was saying that was really good, but as it was good, because number one, we had that 48,000 votes, which created political reality in terms of our ability to aid to either help somebody get an office or to prevent somebody to get an office. Not that we could put anybody in office on our own, but we could either stifle them or we could help somebody else.
So the we could
keep the red guy. We could help the good guy. Quote unquote, you know. We could keep the bad guy.
Yeah. So they sort of presented you with a ticket. Would you accept this bunch of white men to run the city? You would say, well, we
did it just in reverse. We had what was called the Atlanta Negro Voting Bureau. What we would require, all the candidates to come through that voting bureau. We were an executive session that turned me on ABC and D. We did not want to have for that. Once we make that determination, then we would put out a pledge. The significant thing is that black people at that time followed the slate of the Atlanta Negro Voting League 98%. 98%. If we endorsed a candidate, that candidate got 98% of the black vote. And that was a significant
point. But then the white business group came to you with a list of white names, pretty much. You say yes or no. or suggested a list of
Well, I think it, without any question, there was some cooperation with the white power structure. It was the white power structure. At that time, we were working with Buckhead. It was the Atlanta newspaper, Buckhead, and the black leadership that kind of held this city together in terms of its favorable racial relations.
I guess I was curious about whether you suggested the whites you would support, or whether they came to you with a list and missed you for this or not.
No, they did not come with a list. It was done in a fashion that the whites would announce.
Yeah.
We then would make the judgment, but we would make that judgment. And obviously, they also defined the business folks that said, we're for Muggsy Smith.
Right.
Some of them were for Muggsy Smith. We went to Miami, you know, this big, it's not going to be the same way for Miami, but the procedure was generally that we would get together and make the decision. Now, we were welcome to get input from some of our friends and right in the business world, but they never came to us with a list and said, these are our candidates, you folks either take them or leave.
Do you think that type of situation produced a city in which nonviolent civil rights protests was more effective? I mean, obviously things were much worse than Selma or Birmingham. So he had a situation in which nonviolent protest really was able to reach, I guess, the ears of the white leaders much more so than other cities, which had a little bit of that built up since the 1940s. How about Orlando as the center of the civil rights movement? Do you think it became the center? It's there, the CLZ, and all that, because of the religions?
I think that played a role. I think if Atlanta had the same political atmosphere and social atmosphere, social in the sense of the relationship between black and white, as a Selma and Birmingham, that perhaps the movement might have gone elsewhere. The significant thing about Atlanta has always, in my judgment, that though we disagreed violently, they had sense enough to say, well, let's come around the table and let's talk about it. Now that, I think, is a distinguishing feature between the history of Atlanta and the history of some other city. Let me give you a concrete example. When Red Brown came to Atlanta, and went out to Dixie Hill, created a big scene and ready to turn this city upside down. It happened to be in my senatorial district, so I went and camped out there and tried to keep up some peace. The problem you have with that procedure is that you run the risk of being called an uncle from, you run the risk of being saying that you are anti-black and national religion. Sometimes you have to run that kind of thing. But in order for us to wrap around the top of what they didn't have out there, playground, what have you, and he was right, they didn't have it. So the question is, who they going to listen to? That playground, we don't have the playground, we're going to listen to you, who said that it's coming. So I go down and get with Ivan and say, Ivan, listen, I cannot obey Ivan unless the people see some tangible proof of the fact that we're going to do something about the playground. I need some bulldozers out there, leveling off some land to say, look, here's what I said we're going to do, here's what we're doing. I don't think we'll get it. He had the sense enough to understand the bind that we were in. So what he did was to order the people to do it, and the next day we had bulldozers leveling off areas out there where black children can come and play and all, which tend to put credibility, oh, sure, you know, in our arena, vis-a-vis Red Brown.
Yeah, but of course, on the other point, he didn't have enough sense to do it beforehand.
That's right.
Before
Red
Brown came
question.
Along.
No question about that.
So that had to be pushed a little bit.
It had to be pushed.
Yeah.
And I want to make clear that what advantages that we mean black people attained in Atlanta, did not come automatically. Never came because
the white power structure, business or political, felt that it was time to do it, it was right to do it, and therefore we're going to do it. Never. No matter how good this city is today vis-a-vis other cities, it's that way because there's always been a pressing black demand that these things come about.
Sure, he's dealing with you if you look right for him.
That's
sure.
It. It's clear that that issue.
I think that's true in most places. That's what I've heard from other people also. I know Allen Maven, a great guy, he still didn't see the same thing that was happening in the black community that he should have seen. He didn't come from that background, he didn't live it.
Well, one good example is that you put a barricade up and Peyton off office, you know, and when black people began to move in that area, they wanted to stop them. And Ivan, who was now symbol of progress and everything else, he put a barricade up to keep black folks from moving to that area as a deterrent. And one thing that Hartsfield said to Ivan, he said, I made a lot of mistakes in my life, but I never made one in the photograph. Because when he put that barricade up, the newspapers spread it all over the world.
I spoke to him. He's still embarrassed about that.
Yeah.
I want to get over to the Maynard Jackson election in 1972. I was curious, what changed the black community here to have a black mayor?
I think for two things. I think it was several changes. Number one, I think it suggested to black people, you know, that the horizon, the political horizon, locally had been raised. I think we had a general effect on black people when we got elected to the Senate in 1962. But here we're talking about even bringing it closer home because you're talking about a greater area of control of the mayor. And I think it had that effect, that the horizon is connected, that you can go and fill it. You know, that's a great thing. Secondly, I think Maynard's stance probably did more to fortify and to provide backbone of black people than perhaps anything else. By his stance, I mean the way he stood up to, say, the white community, the white business community. He would say no, he would mean no. He was articulate, he would argue effectively on his feet, and the perception of black was that he was a warrior, you know, and that it provided for them, I believe, a kind of fortification that was extremely important. I think they got from me, but that's what I want to do. And the third thing that Maynard did, it was that he, for the first time, provided black people with the opportunity to get a piece of economic power,
joint venture in this city.
And one of the hallmarks of his administration has to be the fact that he insisted on, advocated and insisted on, and perfected a significant joint venture theory here that black people benefit. There's no question.
I guess this was the basis for all the criticism from the beginning of being anti-white and unfortunately, you know, Maynard Jackson's the only one who hasn't been willing to give me an interview so far, but I'd love to talk to him. I think he has a lot to be proud of. So I'm surprised he hasn't been willing to talk, maybe he senses the question. How about your election in 1962? Andy Young's election in 1972 Congress, what changed the black community in relation to that?
Well, going back to 1962, I think the motion was throughout the state that my election probably had a greater effect on blacks. For the simple reason that prior to 1962 they had not been black. in 62, I went into the Senate for an all-white legislature. So the emotional feeling among the black folks, the fact that we have achieved, we have come so far, that we can do thus and so, were just tremendous. To a certain extent, that though I came from the district, the 38th district, excellent with people on the west side of the border, black children in South Georgia thought I was their senator.
So it was a psychological thing.
It was a psychological thing. To a certain extent that in appointing pages, I would appoint pages, not just for my district and my town, but the mother part of Georgia. So it had that kind of emotional effect, you know, on black people, one of the achievements, one of the problems, opportunities. And then, of course, when Andy was in 62, I mean, in 72, but then it again, not represented for blacks, another height. He was a man who was going to home, first black in X number of years. And then in all of that, in my judgment, fortified what I think has now become almost that which black people take for granted. And that is the political level of achievement and involvement that came from our election, from any election, from many elections.
That blacks get elected.
That blacks can get elected. And they think they're not going to get elected, you know, just profoundly.
Yeah. were you anything, being that you're going into the whole white legislature, were you able to do anything really substantial for black people? I think getting their viewpoint across.
Two things that you got to recognize. Number one, if you got one vote in the hand, if you look in terms of, you got to make a judgment. The judgment's got to be, you have a choice. You can go over there and seek to be effective in the legislature by learning the rules better than those who made the rules and learning the way they play the game and seek to be more efficient than any other today and get something. Or you can just become a rebel and get nothing. I decided to do the first. I decided to do that and move better and operate in a more efficient manner than they operate within the system that they carry out. And how I went down to the black community is in the sense of number one, not only do you articulate their view and let it always be known, but then you also try to provide kind of leadership that we give with at intervals will permit them to get certain things done. For instance, people would come to me who had problems with the Department of Labor who needed a job. Well, I created a situation where I could call the Department of Labor and say, look, these people are in terrible homes trying to have some jobs. So we create a summer situation where 15 jobs will go to Calhoun, 20 jobs will go here, 10 jobs will go there. But not happening before. And I made whatever relationship that I developed over there, I did so in the sense that at that time we had what is called a Democratic, Georgia Democratic Organization, that is an organization among black people. Term Wald and started the this organization, black folks would be in the white Democratic Party. So you had a black Democratic organization. And that organization was in all of the states, I mean, in about 50 or 60 of the counties throughout Georgia, making a couple of some animals in all three counties. And Walden was the president of that organization. And of course, in statewide elections, when Douglas would run, you know, he would have his network. And to always turn out X number of black votes. So when he died, I became chairman, president of the Democratic Party. I went in 62, and I became chairman in Georgia. Passed, I believe, in 64, 65, I became chairman in 65. But the result of it is that I had then the same kind of contacts that he had. and to pick up the phone and call the Black leadership in Augusta and make them submit for him and get results.
Get results in terms of putting pressure on the white senators that
white,
are
there? On white senators. Specific example.
After the whole. So you were able to put pressure on white senators down in the southern areas.
Right.
Did you have any impact at all on elections and governor during the time?
Yes, we did. Let me just give you an example. I introduced a bill, for instance, in the Senate that had to do, I think, with teacher tenure. And at that time, you know, nobody would agree with this conversation. Black people were being fired in South Georgia if the superintendent didn't like it. Like the way you fixed your hair, and you know, able to let you know. So that had come to my attention from our people out in the state. So I introduced a bill for teacher tenure that have criteria, you know, you can't file them after 3 years, you know, that's our business. Anyway, the bill went into committee, came out of committee, came on the floor. And the president called for the bill, and we lost it by 2 votes. So I immediately moved for reconsideration. Then, at the end of that session, I went to the Watchdog and called our leadership in Augusta, Savannah, Mayfield, Brunswick, and all over the state. And said, look, get with your senator. He voted against me, and I need him to vote with me tomorrow for reconsideration. So, the next day, the bill came up. Before the bill came up, Paul Brown from Athens came to me and said, Lord, and I don't like pressure. And he had voted against me the day before. And he said, Ray Ware and two or three other people called me from Macon, and I mean, called me from Athens and asked me to vote with you. He said, put pressure on me. I said, I don't like that. I said, I just want you to know that. He said, I understand what you're saying, sir. President called the previous question on that bill, and the first hand that went up the next day was Paul Brown. And the bill passed by 2 votes the following day. To the House.
Well, the perception was that I had a lot of power because of my ability to communicate with Blacks throughout the state. What they didn't understand is that there's kind of a network among Black folks. And unlike what they had been accustomed to, we call each other, we get together, some people call campaigns, but we call political meetings, and we say what we want to do, and we follow that. And during the 60s, we had that kind of allegiance and loyalty. On another occasion, Roscoe Dean had voted against me almost on every bill that I put up. So when he ran for election, I went to his county, and I campaigned actively against him. And he came very close to losing the election. He won the election. But after that, we developed a very good relationship, and I could always depend on his vote.
They didn't like pressure, but they understood it.
They understood it. They didn't like it, but they understood it. So my theory has always been that they don't have to like you, they have to understand you. But they respect you if you have the vote, or if they think you can deliver the vote. But the perception is, whether true or untrue, you can deliver the vote, they respect you.
So you're really the first voice in the state senate that can really speak to the Black community. Was it nobody else? You ran against Paul Weiss, I think, was the first. And your election, I guess, was based on the rapprochement pretty much.
Right.
You made a statement in 1972, I think, that Blacks cannot be planned for, but must be planned with. I think that's probably one of the changes.
Right.
Before that, there's really no voice in our community. Governor, then anybody else would listen to us. I was also curious, you know, I know you were a youth director for the United Neighbor Voters League, and I was curious what the background was related to your being appointed the first Black Assistant Solicitor General.
It was.
Was that definitely, I mean, I don't want to say type of thing, but what was the basis of that?
Well, I was very close to Tim Baldwin. Tim Baldwin was kind of like my mentor. I worked with the United Neighbor Voters League in the youth. And also as one of the, what they call the dean of the school of registration under Dr. Baker, that Dr. Baker created the system. And I was one of the first deans of that. And what we would do is to go to the different areas and teach them how to use the voting machine. Like the voting machine would be in the school and all that sort of thing. So I was very active with the voting machine. I went away to law school and got a degree and came back. But in the process of my being active with the league, Paul Webb ran for the Solicitor General and ran against, I believe, Reuben Garland, Ruth Garland, and two or three others. And Walden extracted an agreement from Paul Webb that if he won, Walden supported him, and if he won, he would put a black person on his staff in the Solicitor office. The Voters League endorsed and supported Webb, and Webb won. And keeping his commitment to Walden, he told Walden, you name somebody, and I'll appoint you to my office as the first chair. I came out of law school and was born in Tuskegee to practice law. Because he really did offer me a free office for a year and all other, some other things that I would come in. It was a small community, 98.1% black, and that sort of thing. And I was in Tuskegee talking to people, negotiating by an office there from Walden County. He said, look, I want you to come back and make a deal with Dr. Miller. An agreement was where. And I like you to take this down. So I came back and talked to him. And that's how it came about. And he appointed me as the first criminal investigator.
I said, obviously, without Black votes, there would be none of that.
No question about it. No question about it.
That's what I see more and more. It was just, I don't get an indication back in the 30s and 20s that any of these ones were Black community. Set on the bond issues of the Black folks. Very little thing. I just wanted to go back to the model thing. That after the whites reneged on the lines of Perry Homes and reneged on some other things, what did the Black community do? What did they do to come back?
Well, at that point, all you could do was protest. Because at that point, the referendum was all we could do then was to say, look, you promised this and you're hard to do it. But there was really no leverage. You know, we lost the leverage, really, when we passed this bond.
Sure.
Everything was gone. And probably the mistake that we made, and I say this, and I now say this, when we advised the president, one of the advisors, Marvin and others, you all got to watch for this, need to watch for that. The one thing I say is that you cannot, first of all, you try to extract the pound of flesh when you have the leverage to do that. But once you extract the pound of flesh, you got to have some guarantee that it can be executed, that they're going to do what they're saying.
And it doesn't guarantee.
Well, you know, and that's where we've always failed. That's why we've always had it. All of our negotiations with Black, from the 60s on down, we can get a commitment, but we failed to get some mechanism by which we can make sure that the commitment will be effective, you know, once that has been accomplished.
I guess the only way to do that is to come back with votes next time I go to the office
and vote in.
Yeah.
I did in one instance in the Senate when there was a question of who should control the Senate. The question came up as to whether we should take the power from the lieutenant governor and give it to a committee to appoint committee chairmen, what have you. Maddox wanted the committee to stay as it was because he wanted to remain the chairman. Carter and his group wanted the reverse. And Head and his group, Senator Webb, who was later the judge, and Bob Smalley from Griffith, very fine guy. And the die had been cast. The votes were cold. And so I was there and made no commitment. The Carter people came to me and said, look, if you vote with us, we'll make you change the temperance committee or some committee. I said, look, I'm a lawyer. I vote with them and change the judiciary. He said, we can't do that. We promised that to Webb. I said, well, that's what I want. Maddox people came to me and said, look, hey, you vote. I said, we'll make you chairman of the judiciary. I said, what do you want? I said, I want chairman of the judiciary. He said, well, let me go back. And we honored with that compromise. He came back and said, we'll do it. So I called Carter. I said, look, I need to get with you and your people. I said, I want to be chairman of the judiciary. Chairman Judiciary Committee had an office, number one, and one of the most powerful committees in the Senate.
Right.
The Rules Committee, the Judiciary Committee, the Appropriations Committee. We had an office, the name and administrative assistant, the secretary. This is what I want. So Carter said, look, you can't vote with him because that matters. You know, there's no way that you can go with him. I said, well, I'm going to tell you this. I said, the question is now is not whether I can go with him. I said, the question is whether I can better represent my people in terms of being able to do more for them by being chairman of the Judiciary Committee or being chairman of the Temperance Committee.
That's right.
Now, I said, that's the real question. So they hit home. So I told Maddox folks, I said, okay, I said, I'll go with you. And incidentally, they needed one vote. They needed one vote to swing it. One way or the other. So I said, I'll go with you provided I get chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and I have a right to name, there's a five-man committee, I have a right to name two persons on the committee. Otherwise, if I be chairman of that committee and they name the people, for, you know, I have, and I can't have no control over the committee, it's like to know.
So they came through here,
so they came through, they said, okay. So they made me chairman. I named the two people. With myself, we had a majority vote on the committee. And when I voted with them, the deal came up. They wanted that the bill passed by one vote. The bill passed by one vote. Maddox maintained his position to appoint chairman. I became chairman of the Judiciary Committee. The results were that I appointed the first black governor to serve as the secretary of the Senate. I was the first black governor for more. Wiley Brampton's son, Wiley Brampton, dean of college school, was the dean of law school at Howard University. His son was at Morehouse, and he was in the administrative assistant. Appointed Paul Nisman, the wife of the university. But that's the way we have to get some kind of charity.
The white state senator represented that district on the west side before you. I guess it wasn't the same district, it was three portions. There was some white senator there, right? He was doing nothing for the black community. Do you care about their votes? I'm just like, we're voting for them.
Well, you know, every 4 years, every 2 years, at the election time, they come to the black churches.
Yeah.
And say, you know, I'm for this, I'm for that. But beyond that, no.
But they never came through.
Never came through. No black folks have ever been appointed to any position in the Senate. I mean, in the federal church. When I went over there, I knew 7 days from the capital. No black person ever even came to the capital. And that's what the system is going.
So I guess the white state senator, though, I mean, he can make his promises. He wouldn't come through, and the black community had nobody else to vote for anyway.
Nobody else to vote for him. He came once a year, and that's when the town from the left came to the church.
I can see why it's tough to register people.
That's it.
Yeah. You were also involved, I think, on the Atlantic Committee for Cooperative Action. I'm just curious what role you played there. what the group actually did. Mm-hmm.
That was a group of black professional women that sought to make a change. In that group, Carl Pogan, was very good. Professor Carl Pogan, who's now here, he instead of the committee in Washington now that deals with urban
centers. He was in Washington?
He lived in Washington. But it was Carl Pogan, Lance Coleman, who was dean of the School of Social Work. Well, and he was not dean at that time. He was with the Urban League. Lance Coleman was the Urban League. But Whitney Young, who was dean of the School of Social Work, Jesse Hill, Q.B. Williamson. Well, it was about 12 or 15.
The main, there was top leadership.
Top leadership. Mm-hmm.
As a part of the American Year for Cooperation.
We came together and did what was called the second look at it, printed it up. And it was looking at it in terms of what it now ought to be. A blueprint for improvement, a blueprint for tomorrow. And it was a very effective group. And it was from that blueprint that we began to single out issues.
This was the 60s, right?
It was in the 60s.
How about the action forum? You know anything about that as well? I've heard that a few times, wasn't quite sure. But
that came later, and that came as a result of some desire to end it in the medical part of action on the ground, in active manner. Now, that came much later, and that was some black people that was some white people to hear that they would be monthly or weekly or bi-weekly or what have you. Talk about issues and try to resolve.
So that's maybe 1971 information? Okay. Yeah. Okay, I also wanted to be curious about the 69 election. The Lantern Choir has appointed myself of the state, and I think you did too, which you're very good. And I think some of the older black leadership also supported Rodney Cook. I was curious why the state didn't get more black support at that point, and why you won the show.
Well, probably two reasons. And this is hindsight. We might have made a mistake in judgment. Yeah, and not supporting Tate at that time. At that time, the view was, in 69, that it would be difficult for Tate to be elected. Rodney Cook was a fair-minded, young councilman, all of them, I think they called him then. LaSalle had been vice mayor and was running for mayor. Rodney was a Republican, LaSalle a Democrat. He had some staunch black Republicans. The feeling was that Tate couldn't get, and the feeling was that if all black people had voted for Tate could not have gotten elected.
So you did not have the votes in the city?
We did not have the votes in the city at that time. We had to have all the black votes plus X number of white votes, in order to get elected. So the theory was, if that be the case, then we need to decide on these two people in terms of what we can extract from them for the black community. We decided to go with LaSalle. When I say we might have been a mistake in terms of we might have been able to, we possibly could have, for the purpose of protest, just gone ahead. That boom, and then let the chips fall where they may over here and say we deal with that later. But we were operating at what we thought was the best posture to take for advancing our cause, the cause of black people at that time. The sale we thought was pliable, and he was. He
and put a lot of black folks in public office, brought them into City Hall, put them on there with the first time we had black and sharing as commissioners, you know, in the city.
He came through, he came
through. So he came through, he came through.
So I guess it was a question just waiting another 4 years, and just
can't say.
Jackson, what, where is your business?
But Michelle came to be on the point blank because he said he would be accessible to blacks. So that's what I did back into the room. Michelle was mayor. And we would have had a difficulty had he not been in favor of my bill.
Sure.
But a lot of whites came out and says he did kind of get there's no business fighting here, you know, and all that sort of business.
But no matter, you know, no matter what Michelle did, he didn't do as much as Jackson was like. You know,
oh,
something special about having a black mayor, right? Just a final point, I was curious about the annexation issue, which you were involved in the first time, and the racial aspect of that. Is that basically a racial split of that issue in terms of consolidating what the campaign?
No question about it. I firmly believe that consolidation will dilute the black vote. Will believe that very firmly. And to my surprise, I firmly believe that consolidation will dilute the black vote. To my surprise, Andy and others did not talk about their fall consolidation. And that seems to me is a foolish position for them to take. You don't give away power, you know. But anyway, so I've always fought consolidation. Now, the theory was that they wanted, they being certain white legislators, wanted to annex and this Sandy Spring, which in my judgment would have diluted the black vote.
Right.
So Rodney Cook was in the legislature at that time and others, and they put in the bill to annex Sandy Spring. I fought it. I got them to agree that if they put the bill in, they also put a bill in to annex Fairburn Road in that area.
Okay. What's the road?
It's west of Atlanta, and it's called Fairburn Road. It's a name for it, and I'll think of it in a minute. It's like Sandy Spring, but we have the name.
I think I remember it from, I don't remember the name, I remember when.
But it's the Fairburn Road area.
Yeah.
So I think if you put in the bill, no bill, that you would annex the Fairburn Road area, then I will support it. It's an all-in-one. So they put the bill in that will annex Sandy Spring and will annex the Fairburn Road area. And it required for each area to vote to come in order for them to be annexed. So the bill passed. So I got our folks together, black people together. We went out to the Fairburn Road area and talked to those folks, told them about things, and told them about the vote to come in. So Cook and his crew go out to the Sandy Spring area to get those folks. So we sent a delegate out to the Sandy Spring area, told the vote to come in. Told the vote to come in. But right away they saw red or black. They saw both and said, wait a minute, what are we doing here? We don't want to annex to Atlanta and those black folks are there, you know. So the result being is that the Fairburn Road area voted to come in. The Sandy Springs area voted to stay in. So we've annexed, in effect, we enlarged the boundary in the
area that brought more black folks in to get the area, to get the benefits of the city government of Oklahoma. The Santa Fe people never came in.
I read some of Hockville's speeches from that period. He was out in Santa Fe saying, at least come in tomorrow. It was obviously an anti-black statement. Sure. Very strong. Do you know anything about a two-city plan that Marcel came up with at one time? About splitting Atlanta to north and south both the cities? I came across that once, but I haven't been able to find anything more about it. The annexation issue really then was not about city services or land, so it was race.
It was purely race. It was a question of the mood of that way. To a certain extent, that Harold Clark, who was a lawyer from, I believe, a sign down in that area, he's now in the Supreme Court on the Court of Appeals one. He was in the legislature at that time. And he put it in here to annex Atlanta and Fulton County. And everybody thought it was a joke. Do you know that bill passed the House and came to the Senate? And when it got to the Senate, I put a bill in the meantime, I put a bill in to annex the area where he lived with another area. It was just a kind of a trade-off. But anyway, his bill passed his House and came to the Senate. And the question, if the bill that passed the Senate in Atlanta, Fort Canada, it was there that then I pulled in my political field. And Hugh Gillis, you want to get something in the Senate done, you have to get Hugh Gillis, Carver Kidd, I believe it was Jackson from Augusta. You got about five of us to go with you, and you're in fairly good shape of preventing the bill from passing. And at that point, I was able then to get Carver and Hugh and two or three others to vote with me to kill that bill. And the way I did it was that Hugh Gillis had a bill at one time that came up. His father, who was head of the highway committee, wanted to pave some roads down in his area. And obviously he had a personal reason for wanting to pave it, you know. But the point is that on that particular issue, he came over and asked me to vote with him. And the vote was real funny. So I said, Hugh, and I knew it was real funny. So I said, Hugh, I said, if I vote with this, you're over the phone. He says, okay. So the bill came up, I voted with him. But when the bill came up, and Clark bill hit the Senate, and the question was whether or not it would pass it. I called you, I said, you owe me one. I want to collect it on this bill. And we defeated the bill. We defeated it. But the annexation, you know, was a racial, had nothing to do with the question of saving the city money, city services, and the question of diluting the black vote. And it's supposed to be
a fight. It was hard for the white politician to accept the fact that the blacks had well, it still isn't. You know, when I hear Dan Swift talking about consolidation stuff, and it's still coming from the same area. To the white power structure, they still want to bring in the rest of Fulton County for obvious reasons.